Hi, this is Pep Phelan from the Poach Centre, and I have with me today Christy Cooper, an Aboriginal nurse from Tasmania. Hi, Christy, how are you doing?
Hey, Pep, how are you?
I'm good. Tell me more about yourself, your profession, where you're from, and your pathway to getting into nursing.
Yeah, Pep, I'm a Palawa person from Lutruwita, Tasmanian Aboriginal woman. Yeah, I grew up here on the west coast of Tasmania. My dad's family grew up in the southeast of Tasmania. That's where my Indigenous heritage is linked to. And I graduated nursing with UTAS in 2005, having attended college on the northwest coast, so moving away to attend college and then university in Launceston. So yeah, I've moved around a little bit prior to getting into nursing, and then yeah, nursing's provided me with lots of opportunity to move about and call many countries home. Yeah, I kind of started in the northwest coast, kind of doing a bit of critical care, and then like most people from the country and Indigenous people, I had an urge to return home and to contribute to the healthcare access on the west coast. So spent some time there. After a couple of years, I took the opportunity to work a little bit interstate. I've had a lot of varied and diverse nursing experiences, I guess, in different kind of contexts and different states. But yeah, quite passionate about nursing and about the opportunities nursing has offered me, as well as the opportunity to particularly improve healthcare access in rural and remote areas. Mm-hmm. Which I spent a fair bit of my life.
What got you interested in your professional field, like nursing, and what additional training have you done on top of your sort of undergrad training? What area of work have you gone into, and why are you really interested in that aspect?
Well, I don't know how proud I am to say this, actually, Pam. When I was in high school, I didn't have a lot of ambition to move away from home and attend uni. Or the college, there wasn't year 11 and 12 offered locally, so you had to move an hour and a half away. One of my science teachers, Mr. Batty was his name, he said, I was talking to him about, he was engaging me and wondering what I wanted to do, what would I do after grade 10. And yeah, I had for the entire time at high school kind of thought that I wanted to be a flight attendant. I really wanted the opportunity to travel. And he started to, paint the picture of a flight attendant who female and maybe of childbearing age and the kind of opportunities in terms of managing life and family life, life and work. And then he just said, why don't you do nursing? And yeah, that was that influence that, I decided to do nursing. In year 11 also, I was in a car accident. So I had to pick subjects that would enable me to do nursing kind of for year 11. And yeah, early on, I think only in the March, I was in a car accident when I was returning to the West Coast from college. There was an oil spill on an open country road and it started to rain and yeah, the driver had lost control. So I spent 2 weeks lying flat in hospital with a fractured C6 and C7 vertebra. Quite a traumatic experience, really, to lie flat and have all your bodily functions attended to by somebody else, often male nurses, and I found that quite difficult and intimidating at the age of 16. But I guess that was quite, clarifying as well that I would like the opportunity to improve the dignity of individuals kind of in that vulnerable situation like I found myself. So, yeah, I continue on to do nursing and, I fast-tracked through the program, which was good. I did a summer school program and finished in 4.5 years. So it was a good opportunity to get into the workforce. I was eager to get into the workforce. And I've been in the workforce since I was about 12, kind of working for a family-owned and operated company back on the West Coast and World Heritage Cruises and doing some work in waitressing. So yeah, I was keen to enter the workforce. And once I did, I loved it, loved nursing. learn a lot from the nurses in my graduate years and things. I'm really fortunate to have had good mentors. Some of those mentors are still in my life and, yeah, I've been really supportive even if I've been working interstate. When I decided to return to the West Coast after kind of 2 years of nursing, you know, going from a regional hospital to a rural hospital, your scope of practice certainly changes. Your level of clinical responsibility changes, scope of the presentations you might see, and, you know, the healthcare emergencies you might come into contact with. Yeah, and I started to soon know after working there that I needed to increase my skill set. I remember I had a man come in with a foreign body in his eye, and yeah, the GP that was on call, I'd called him out over after hours, and he criticized me saying it wasn't a medical emergency. Although, you know, we only get two eyes. I decided to enroll in postgraduate studies, and I did them with Flinders University, the Centre for Remote Health in Alice Springs. Yeah, it was really good. The first year of the program was, you know, really about advanced assessment and kind of those assessment skills that you don't often use a lot of in hospital settings. So looking in eyes and ears, yeah, suturing and plastering, advanced kind of musculoskeletal examination. Yeah, that was really good. And at that time, we had to do an intensive block in Alice Springs. So that was real opportunity for someone from the west coast of Tasmania to have that opportunity to apply to the Alice. Beautiful country. Yeah, and some lots of unique learning opportunities in going in itself. But I also was able to connect with a lot of allied health professionals, actually, from working across Australia, particularly some folks from Northwest Primary Healthcare in Queensland. Speech pathologist, physiotherapist, an occupational therapist. And it was kind of at this time I was quite inspired about, you know, the opportunities in remote health to be able to use work as a means to move around, but to live and contribute. Yeah, so I returned home and I worked really hard and saved some money, moved in with mum, and then left Tassie late into that graduate year. I didn't think I was going to continue on a master's program. Then, yeah, moving around, I found myself in a remote single nurse post role on Yamachi country in Western Australia, kind of on the Midwest Gascoyne region, about 12 hours north of Perth and 12 hours south of Broome. And, yeah, it was a single nurse post, so just the one health professional for the community, a week on, a week off role. So you were working on call. The socio-demographics of the community were, you know, a marine hospitality community, largely tourism. It was leased land, station land, Indigenous and non-Indigenous population, a lot of overseas backpackers kind of doing transient work, kind of a transient marine hospitality industry. So scuba diving, lots of sun, lots of coral cuts. But the population was younger. And yeah, I started to realize that, again, my skills, I needed to adapt to the community needs. And at that time, there was a little bit of need for some more sexual health and women's health, a lot of sexually transmitted infection screening, contraception management, you know, cervical smear testing. It was at that point that I thought I'll continue on with the master program and with Flinders. And yeah, the second year of that program looked at women's sexual and reproductive health, men's health, family planning, and child development and immunization. Uh-huh. And a little bit of antenatal care as well.
When you were up there, were you the only health professional working for that community?
Yeah. So for a week on at a time, there was another nurse. I lived in the community, but there was another nurse that flew in and flew out. So effectively for my week on, there wasn't another health professional around, but for their week on, I was around, but I was busy studying most of the time, or snorkeling, or laying on the beach. Camping under the stars. And also in that community, there wasn't a school and there wasn't police presence. So, yeah, I guess the role of the remote area nurse there also extended beyond direct healthcare to kind of supporting the community. Anytime there was trauma or crisis, you know, the physical environment, but also, yeah, the social, emotional well-being of the community. So, you know, it was a real privilege coming from, yeah, the west coast of Tasmania, where it's very cold and not cyclonic, to experiencing natural disaster and, you know, the geographic isolation that comes with that.
Obviously, everyone has different work values and different personal values. How have your core values underpinned the work that you do?
I guess ultimately, I like to, over time, I've found that working with purpose is really important to me. Really need to feel that the work I do provides value to the community. Sometimes, you know, different contexts of practice, that's difficult to achieve. And it's probably why I'm attracted to kind of rural and remote health. It's really special to be able to relate to individuals from all walks of life, to provide non-judgmental healthcare access. And yeah, just to be a point of call, like, you know, there was, you know, working remotely, you know, it's about building up trust and security in the health service, you know, for individuals. Can come and go as they please, and you know, people would just drop in for a yarn as opposed to for any direct health issue. Sometimes people come in and just sit down and just start crying, and you know, just need to have to get it out. Not that I was able to provide solutions to those individual concerns and complaints or issues or experiences. It's just being there and being able to share in those. Mm-hmm. And confidentiality is a big component of that too. And yeah, so I feel like confidentiality is a bit of a core value that hopefully I can work with individuals to, you know, feel that safety. And when people get to know me over time, that they have faith in my demonstrated history to uphold the values of confidentiality and working with integrity like that.
How did you separate your professional life from your personal life working in such a small and remote community? Obviously, you and I have had similar experiences. I worked as a clinical counsellor and psychotherapist in a remote community. And, you know, you see people that you work with every single day at the local supermarket because there's only one. You see them at trivia night. You see them everywhere you go, basically. How did you separate it? Because I know for me, a lot of my clients would stop me in the supermarket and want to have a conversation about things that had happened during professional sessions with me. And they're obviously not the right places to have conversations like that. So how did you separate your personal and your professional self within that space?
It's fortunate, you know, I did reflect critically on these aspects of practice in remote health when doing the remote health masters. You know, this lack of anonymity, you know, that everybody knows you. Yeah, and I definitely did experience times, yeah, in public places. There weren't a lot of places in this town, but there was the pub. After our, you know, when I was an on-call, you know, I could enjoy socialising with the community that, you know, all become my family. Yeah, sometimes people would be a little inappropriate in terms of conversation. You know, handling those situations, I recall one vividly. And I guess it's not to disempower the individual or demean them, you know, in shutting them down quickly, but, you know, maybe reminding them that we could have a yarn about that another time. The strange thing is, though, Pep, when I didn't have as much trouble adjusting to that than I did when I found myself living in Melbourne, you know, for a period of time, and then that real sense of anonymity in a crowd, and I really I felt I lost a sense of self in the crowd like that. I did grow up rurally, yeah, only in a town of probably, yeah, 500 to 1,000 people. So always kind of known in a smaller community, and learned early that you are kind of responsible for your actions and kind of maintaining community spirit, I guess, looking out for others and, you know, not kind of embarrassing yourself too much or acting out or, you know, thinking that there might be ramifications for your behaviour. But I guess in a bigger population, you might not have those ramifications so much. Interesting. But yeah, look, the lack of anonymity in that community that I was working as a sole nurse, I guess it's an aspect that at times was draining when you were probably needing a break. But it's something that, yeah, I learned to love about the role and, you know, I didn't find it a chore to find time or be with people at work or after hours in the community. Yeah.
I suppose when you are living in a smaller community, you find yourself much more cognizant of the role that you have when it comes to community responsibility. And I think a lot of people within cities, working in larger cities and centres, don't necessarily understand, I don't know, how much of a sense of purpose that it can give you working in a small community because, you know, you are the only health professional working in that particular centre and people do have a genuine respect and recognition for the skills and the knowledge that you have. That's why I liked it because I could work directly with the head doctor at the hospital and be called into the hospital to do work that I would not be asked to do within larger cities.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess it goes two ways. Look, we did have a volunteer ambulance service. These people had, you know, first aid certificates, but they had compassion and purpose in their role because they were directly contributing to their role. And, you know, I couldn't do that role without them. You know, when the Royal Flying Doctors did come in for a retrieval, you know, some of, you know, the, you know, working with the community members to clear the runway, you know, we didn't have a sealed airstrip. You know, we had to, if it was in the night, we needed volunteers to put out lights. They used to do a run down the runway before in the four-wheel drive, tooting the horn and flashing the lights before the aircraft would land just to make sure there was no wildlife on the airstrip. You know, when we would finally package the individual up and they would go, there would be a collaborative moment of joy and, you know, appreciation for the teamwork to get that individual to safer healthcare location. The opportunity to work with individuals with this remote location, with geography, you know, there were some people that were there that hadn't, you know, majority had no direct family members. They might have their partners, but yeah, a lot of particularly international backpackers that were visiting doing their seasonal work. I recall and time with an individual who, yeah, had been experiencing an acute episode of ill health for some weeks, but was so socially isolated that they couldn't present early to the clinic. You know, sometimes maybe if you've got, and you know, this individual was experiencing an ectopic pregnancy and she really was late to present. And yeah, she was nearly unconscious soon after her arrival. So she was critically unwell and she was in life-threatening danger. In the context of her situation, you know, she'd been living in the community for some time, but she was a little bit introverted and she didn't have a strong social network. You know, the people that she worked with were a lot males, so she wouldn't probably confide in those males about her ongoing abdominal pain or vaginal discharge and bleeding. You know, maybe if you're in another context, you might call your mum, you know, but then you might not want to call your mum because they're going to worry and they're over in Europe, you know. So, you know, understanding the lived experience of living in a remote location. And, yeah, I think the impact of social isolation for all the individuals living in that community or the potential for social isolation on top of geographic isolation, that provides the uniqueness of remote health context. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, you know, the cultural and historical kind of histories of the communities.
What have you learned about influence, impact, and leadership from the work that you do?
You know, having had the opportunity to work and live on Wurundjeri country for 4 years, the hospital settings in Tasmania are quite significantly smaller than those centres in Melbourne. Having the opportunity to work there, I guess I started to see individuals that had been working in tertiary hospital settings for a very long period of time or mostly their whole careers. their whole working lives, and they may have only worked in that one department. So yeah, I started to see kind of, the limitations to the practice approaches and also the acute care biocentric kind of models of practice. And certainly we need tertiary health institutions, but I guess I could see that there was fragmentation between acute and primary care. You know, there's a lack of communication between these bodies. I think, promoting just in day-to-day practice, promoting awareness of these issues that to me seemed so obvious, but to others may not. So I guess just working with individuals to consider kind of population health needs in the context of acute care. And I think sometimes that those needs are maybe overlooked or felt like that they belong to primary health care. And I think this is a kind of a still that fragmented kind of care approach. I remember, feeling when I was working in one institution in Melbourne, there was a cyclone happening up in the northwestern Australia, and it was devastating the communities, and I was really concerned. But yeah, I went to work and nobody spoke about it, and I realised that because they're not immediately impacted by the weather, that they're not sharing in that trauma, then they really are disengaged from it. And I feel like in terms of leadership, we can't be disengaged from the needs of our communities, and they, the geography of Australia is so vast. We have many unique needs across our communities, and I really feel like, Victoria provides an example of really resource rich in terms of healthcare access. World leading research institutes, world leading cancer centres, world leading brain and spinal cord rehabilitation programs. I think that's one good thing about COVID coming out, that, perhaps these largest centres have a potential to contribute to rural and remote communities in many different ways. And that's important in terms of impacting healthcare culture, redirecting our focus on biomedical kind of cures to thinking about how we can support access and, professional development opportunities for remote healthcare professionals as well. With the COVID, we've been really utilising IT and virtual spaces more productively, and that's become the new norm. So yeah, I'm really hoping to see that larger centres that are resource rich can really try and engage with broader communities and overcome these kind of geographic but also cultural barriers that have existed in that way in which healthcare operates. That's the kind of leadership to impact change by thinking about what our roles are as healthcare leaders and how will we improve the health outcomes and healthcare access to comprehensive and quality healthcare. We need a lot of resource to do that, so we need to kind of think creatively with the use of our resources.
Within your field of nursing, particularly rural and remote health, in what ways can non-Indigenous people learn about leadership and ways of doing, being and knowing from their Indigenous colleagues?
Yeah, particularly in rural and remote health, I guess, this our Indigenous worldview, we're very relational and, we're not so much focused on the hierarchical kind of structure of society. And, in the rural and remote context, certainly when you're living and working in a community, that role delineation between work and home is much more blurred. And for some people, that might feel very uncomfortable. But I guess for an Indigenous Australian, myself, I feel quite comfortable with that. I'm prepared and available to not exceed my professional scope of practice, but to exceed probably the traditional notion of Western nursing, clocking on at this time and finishing up and going home. I'm okay with being there for individuals when they need. I think our non-Indigenous peers have opportunity to learn from our approaches and, you know, understand that being with people doesn't necessarily need to have a power dynamic that traditional kind of healthcare practices have. Learning from Indigenous knowledges and Indigenous people and, you know, working collaboratively with your Indigenous peers and your non-Indigenous peers, there is a lot of opportunity for two-way learning about different ways of being with the people that are seeking our support in a time of need.
If you had a major influence over your profession and your industry, the health industry, in what ways would you change it and how would you change it?
Well, particularly for nursing, I'd really love to see nurses working to full scope. I think that there's still a lot of structural inequities for nurses, a lot of overlapping of roles. In healthcare in general, yeah, a lot of potential overlapping of roles or, you know, roles that could be delegated, but because traditionally that has been the role of another health professional. And sticking with that past understanding of what the role and needs of the communities are, as opposed to thinking about innovations in practice approaches, more collaborative practice, nurses working to their full scope. I got a nurse practitioner endorsement back in 2012 and still seeing very few roles for nurse practitioners in our healthcare system. And, you know, hearing of nurses not choosing to want to take the pathway of the nurse practitioner because there aren't job opportunities. That's really frustrating given that we have global and national chronic condition crisis. Maybe the model, the traditional model of healthcare responded to the needs of the communities when infectious diseases were primarily the foundation for ill health. You know, fortunately for public health measures like immunization, you know, we've seen that focus on infectious diseases not as prevalent in communities. And now I just think we're more about chronic conditions. So I guess chronic condition prevention is really important, and we're not seeing a lot of opportunity for nurses to integrate prevention models across all aspects of nursing care. So yeah, I'd like to see nurses working to their full scopes. I'd like to see prevention, you know, the paradigm of prevention, to integrate it into acute and every aspect of healthcare. Yeah, it would be great to see a healthcare system where particularly nurses see themselves transitioning practice context with no barriers, you know, so being educationally equipped to adapt to the needs of the context and the needs of the communities.
For any person looking to commit to a career in nursing, particularly your area of expertise, which is rural and remote health, is there any piece of advice that you could give them?
Anything you would like to achieve. Take some dedication to get through your higher education. But, you know, there are a lot of, you know, good mob doing good work, particularly CATS and AM, and universities have support services available to not only provide support in terms of, you know, study support, but, you know, social support, like I said, to overcome that, those impact of social isolation in any context, especially if you do have to move away to go to university. If you're wanting to go back to rural and remote health, you know, good grounding in, you know, the basics in acute care is useful to identify what the standards of practice are and, you know, the practices approaches that are driven by protocol. It becomes easy to ingrain them and access those protocols and understand what your role is. The Congress of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Nurses and the Council for Remote Area Nurses Australia overlap at times in, you know, some of the education and skill preparation to succeed in that context. I always say prior preparation prevents piss poor performance. So taking that philosophy and, you know, preparing yourself for, you know, working in isolation, for the lack of anonymity, for the extension in your scope of practice, so clinical skills. It's good to identify somebody who can gain clinical supervision and mentorship from. I've done that multiple times with my advancing my scope of practice. So, you know, I worked with the regional midwife, took a lot of additional commitment, so extra hours of my life that I really enjoyed and valued and have grown personally and professionally because of as well as made networks of people that I now consider still my professional network, but family as well, to upskill and, you know, to, in a way, sadly, to protect yourself from finding yourself in circumstances where your skill set isn't meeting the needs of the community, or potentially may find yourself needing to demonstrate how your skill set meets the needs of the communities appropriately. And you know, that could well be in a court of law. Having invested in your professional development should safeguard you a little bit from that. And then, yeah, I guess just calling ahead to a community. You know, nursing shortages are, you know, in rural and remote health are something like 400%. It's not difficult to get a contract. My encouragement would be to work with an organisation that have rural and remote contracts all around Australia, or work with the local communities. So try and, when I tended to move around, I would just engage the local health service and try and organise a, you know, a 3-month contract to begin. That 3 months, you get a good feel of, you know, whether you're feeling like this type of setting is for you. Maybe start with a bit of regional work. If you've come from a metropolitan background, start with a bit of a, go to a regional or rural hospital. It's a good way to develop your capability to work in isolation rather than stepping into an isolated autonomous role by yourself, and realizing, you know, we are socialized in healthcare to rely on the system and the resources of the healthcare team and facilities. So, you know, when you remove those resources, it can be a bit of a culture shock.
What do you see as the major keys to improving and empowering Indigenous lives, both locally and around the world?
We're looking at achieving the aspirations of individuals, opportunities to fully participate in education, to fully participate in employment, to fully participate in healthcare, the delivery, the design, and the governance. And that has to be a multi-systems approach. And I guess that's why community-controlled Aboriginal health organisations, who kind of are the entrepreneurs nationally but also globally for primary healthcare models, we can learn from these models in, you know, kind of mainstream institutions, that we need to be a lot more flexible and more dynamic, and there must be this intersectional collaboration. So education and healthcare and employment sectors must collaborate to enable opportunities for individuals to empower themselves, right? Empowerment doesn't come from somebody necessarily supporting you or telling you what to do. Empowerment, I think, grows when a group of Aboriginal people come together and learn from one another and are empowered from that, creating space for this to take place, and individuals will empower themselves.
Chrissy, thanks so much for coming in and having a chat. It was fantastic to hear your insights and all of your knowledge, particularly working in rural and remote health.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks for having me. And really nice to share that with you.